Welcome to the IPF edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the pulmonary fibrosis community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, contributing writer for Rare Disease Advisor. We're here in New York City with Dr. Noah Greenspan, a cardiopulmonary and complex medical physical therapist. He's also founder and director of the Pulmonary Wellness and Rehabilitation Center, the nonprofit Pulmonary Wellness Foundation, and the New York-based COVID Rehabilitation and Recovery Clinic at H&D Physical Therapy. Thank you, Noah, for being with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. So I've been a physical therapist for about 30 years. I am a board-certified specialist in cardiovascular and pulmonary rehabilitation and physical therapy. And I basically treat people who are, basically the most complex patients in the book. So people with heart disease, respiratory disease, multiple medical conditions. And over the past year, we've kind of repurposed to treat COVID patients, and in particular, COVID long haulers.
What is your overriding philosophy with regard to treating COVID patients?
My overriding philosophy is really the same as my philosophy on everything else, which is really by any means necessary. So first do no harm, and then after doing no harm, basically whatever it takes to get that patient better is what we're going to do. And the other aspect of what's crucial in what we do is that every patient must be treated as an individual, and every patient must be super assessed, super worked up, super evaluated to make sure that, number one, we're not going to hurt people, to make sure that we we're aware of potential dangers and negative impacts of what we're going to do, and then to basically treat the person where they are on that day. And that involves, monitoring, that involves very, very comprehensive communication with the patient on both a personal and a medical level. And it's the philosophy is just pay attention and work as hard as you can.
Okay, with the number of COVID deaths having just surpassed 600,000 in the United States, and yet major states such as New York and California dropping all mask requirements, with the exception of air travel, how do you see the situation developing right now with regards to coronavirus?
So when it comes to coronavirus, my answer to 90% of the questions is the same, which is I don't know. Every week it's like we hear a new headline, right? And it's the headline is, respiratory virus and pulmonary fibrosis and new crop of lung transplant patients. Then it's cardiovascular, then it's neurologic, then it's, MECFS. So the answer is it's a constantly and continually evolving situation. So I don't think anybody has the answer. Personally, it's very fast for my taste, okay? As you know, you asked me, do I want to wear masks during this? I want to wear a mask in almost all situations where I'm going to come in contact with somebody who may have come in contact with somebody who may have come in contact with somebody. So I think the answer is what's going to happen, we don't know. I will always err on the side of caution. That's my background. It comes from my 30 years in complex medical rehab and almost 20 years in EMS. I'm always going to err on the side of caution. So to me, it seems very fast. But only time will tell. For me, I'm not changing the way I do things. I am continuing to take the utmost precautions for myself, for my family, and for my patients.
How concerned are you with the emergence of new variants right now?
So I'm concerned. We're not talking about like a cold or the sniffles here, okay? So I'm concerned. The new variants are said to be, easily spread, easily transmitted. Some people say they're more dangerous. Some people say they're less dangerous. The good news is that the vaccines seem to offer protection against the variants. So I'm concerned because, you know, again, it's not a hangnail. It's not, you know, a foot fungus. It's a life and death situation. So if you are one of the unlucky ones to get infected, you know, it has potential ramifications. But I'm optimistic in that the vaccines seem to be doing a good job against the variants.
And yet, depending on where we speak of in the United States, a fair number of people have not taken the vaccine and don't plan to.
Yep.
So what do you think about that? And especially with regard to, you know, patients with things like pulmonary fibrosis and pulmonary hypertension and other diseases of that nature.
Yeah. So what I think of it, I'll tell you what I think it means, and then I'll tell you what I think of it, because they're two separate things. So what do I think it means? I don't know. And what should people do? I don't necessarily know. But what do I think? I think that COVID came at a very unfortunate time in the history of the world, but in particular in the history of the United States. We are living in a time, and, you know, unfortunately, we have been living in a time where Coke versus Pepsi, or, McDonald's versus Burger King can trigger a fight between people. Okay, so it doesn't surprise me that something, you know, and it's unfortunate, but the idea that something as prolifically profoundly dangerous and important as COVID, a global pandemic, was so highly politicized is really unfortunate.
Do you feel that, and looking from the standpoint of your patients, that we're opening up too fast?
I do. I definitely think we're opening up too fast because, you know, again, first of all, if you think about my patients, okay, so my patients are the oldest, sickest, most complex patients in the book. So we closed the original Pulmonary Wellness and Rehabilitation Center on March 10th, 2020. And the reason for that is because I couldn't justify somebody with heart disease, lung disease, multiple medical conditions coming out to do physical therapy and or rehabilitation. So when you heard the initial warnings about people who were at risk, it was the older patient. It was people with heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, obesity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, pre-existing conditions, right? And there's a joke that George W. Bush once made, and he was giving a speech, and he said, some people call you the elite. I call you my base. And, you know, when they were talking about who's the most at risk, that was my base. That was a who's who roll call of every single one of my patients. So do I still advise those patients to go out and act as if everything is normal again? No, you have to take precautions. And I think that, you know, again, I err on the side of caution. So my philosophy on any type of potential affliction with any type of, you know, ailment is I take universal precautions. And what I mean by that is I assume that everybody's got it until proven otherwise. And if you take that approach, then at least you know you're protected.
At this point, what percentage of your patients are COVID long haulers?
So at this point, it's a very high percentage because that's where our focus is. So we've actually laid off a lot of the cardiopulmonary rehab for the past year, and we've kind of redeployed those patients to more online programs or more self-guided programs, the Pulmonary Wellness Boot Camp, because we wanted to get in this long hauler mix because it's a very, very urgent situation. People don't realize it. You know, we talk about the numbers of cases and we talk about the numbers of deaths, right? And one thing that I've heard from people over and over again is, yeah, I survived, but this is not living. So I think people really don't understand how damaging and debilitating being a long hauler is, or having long COVID is and can be. So there are people who can't work. There are people who can't take care of their families. There are people who can't take care of themselves because of long COVID. And these are not the people you would normally think. These aren't the 80-year-olds with multiple medical conditions. These are mostly women in their 30s, 40s, 50s that were not only healthy before, they were fit. They were not only fit, they were athletic. And now these people are debilitated. So, you know, A huge number of what we do now is COVID-related, and in fact, we don't want this swept under the rug. Like, it seems like people are very anxious to get on with life as usual, but that's impossible for some people. And in fact, we're making a movie now. We're making a documentary called Long Haul, which is about long COVID, because we think that people need to know. And, you know, again, much like everything in our country, you know, a lot of it's political and a lot of it is black and white. So it's like the idea is it's either 100 or it's zero. So either people know it intimately or they know nothing about it. And for the ones that know nothing about it, you know, it's like if they don't see it, then they don't believe it.
Well, you know, I, as you remember, I had the pleasure of visiting your clinic before anybody heard the word coronavirus.
Yep.
And you had any number of patients in their 80s. I think there's even one lady in her 90s.
No, we had plenty. I mean, we, you know, it wasn't unusual to have five 95-year-olds in the room at the same time. And here in New York City, I got news for you. Very often, these 95-year-olds were more contemporary than anybody on my staff. They were going to, you know, three events a week. They were going to the top restaurant openings and theater openings in town. So for me, it's, you know, age is you know, I don't want to say it's just a number, but, you know, I love these people who get up into their 80s, 90s, and 100s because there's something special about them. You know, that's not by accident. There's something about them that makes them succeed and excel and survive.
And yet, those same people are now, with the coronavirus, relegated to online activities and continuing their exercise and their regimen and their treatments remotely. Can you talk about that a bit? How have patients managed to do that that transformation?
So for the majority of patients, it's been an okay transformation. So there are things that we gain from it. There are things that we lose from it, right? So when we first developed Boot Camp a couple of years ago, you know, it was a really it was a long thought out process, and I had always kind of shied away from remote therapy. Why? I had concerns. Number one, I had concerns that we couldn't adequately monitor people, okay? One of the things about what we do in-house is that we monitor people very closely. Everybody is hooked up to an EKG. We're monitoring their heart rate and rhythm throughout the exercise sessions. We're checking blood pressures every 5 minutes. We're checking oxygen saturation and giving oxygen. So that was obviously a concern to me. The other thing was, because of this monitoring, we're able to push people in a way that we wouldn't necessarily do if we didn't have that eye on their physiology. But how we came to sort of go around that was the following. Was number one, we made Boot Camp, instead of a 2-day-a-week program, we made it 7 days a week. So it's a 42-day program. It's 6 weeks, and each day you're given a certain set of materials to do: exercises, meditations, yoga, tai chi, qigong, balance, breathing exercises, flexibility exercises, strength training, thoughts and motivations. And by doing it 7 days a week for 42 days, people actually got significantly better. So if you would have asked me 5 years ago, what do I think about, you know, remote rehab, I would have had a much lesser, less favorable opinion of it. But it serves its purpose, and it's certainly a lot better than contracting COVID. Right. So sometimes we have to do things out of necessity.
You mentioned that you closed the clinic on March 14th.
March 10th. Yep.
March 10th, 2020. Is there any plan on reopening it?
So, yeah, not that exact one. But yes, you know, this is really where I live and breathe. No pun intended. Right.
And at what point will you feel that we're over COVID? What has to happen for you to have that level of confidence that you can reopen your center?
So I'm getting to a point where I'm thinking about opening a center. Okay, so I'm thinking, you know, sometime between, let's say, the fall and the end of the year, right? So I will most likely open another center. Mm-hmm. You know, unquestionably, we will be taking different precautions than we did before. We've always taken super precautions when it comes to, you know, health and safety. So in other words, if one of my staff members wakes up with the sniffles and we don't know if it's a cold or an allergy, they stay home. Same with our patients, okay? We've always taken that very, very seriously. When we build a new center, we're going to be taking into account a little bit more social distancing, meaning like spacing the machines a little further apart, maybe having less people at a time in the gym. Circulation and ventilation and purification of the air. But you know, we're getting there. I'm not quite there yet. And I would be there a lot more quickly if more people would get vaccinated, right? But when you hear about these kind of diehards, you know, that really don't want to get vaccinated at any cost, often for the wrong reasons, right? That makes it more challenging. So it's like we're paddling as hard as we can, but there are still people shooting holes in the boat. And I don't say that with judgment. You know, I'm not saying, hey, you're a jerk, you should get vaccinated. And certainly many people have valid reasons for not getting vaccinated. However, I think that in most cases, not necessarily all cases, but I certainly think in a high majority of cases, the argument for vaccination outweighs the argument not to get vaccinated.
What kind of practical information would you offer healthcare professionals who may be listening to this in order to improve care for their patients?
Well, first and foremost, I would say keep an open mind, okay? I would say don't jump to conclusions. Don't allow yourself to be tricked into or don't trick yourself into a knee-jerk reaction, right? And keep your mind open. And when you think about differential diagnosis, you really have to cast a broad net, even when it's a condition that is not seen very often. Because it's one of those things where, like, you know, if you think of it like a plane crash, right? Like, it's not something that's going to happen often. In fact, the odds of it are very, very low.
But when
it does happen, it's going to be serious. So I'd say when a patient comes in and they're reporting shortness of breath and their pulmonary function tests are abnormal, well, it's very easy to say, well, what is it most likely to be? Where is it most? It's most likely to be something, you know, COPD or emphysema or asthma or chronic bronchitis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But again, cast a wide net. Be open to the idea that those aren't the only lung conditions and that there are, you know, there are conditions like interstitial lung diseases that if it is that, then time is really of the essence. So it's cast a wide net, continually evaluate and reevaluate the differential diagnosis and don't get set in your ways and don't get to the point where you assume you know without doing your due diligence.
Well, as long as we're talking about rare diseases, I'd like to move to pulmonary hypertension.
Sure.
And as I understand, there are several different kinds of pulmonary hypertension, some kinds which affect very young people.
Absolutely.
What can we say about specifically pulmonary arterial hypertension?
So whether we talk about pulmonary arterial hypertension or pulmonary hypertension of other causes, you know, again, a lot of the same things apply, which are that, you know, as medical professionals, we have to keep an open mind. We have to cast a wide net in terms of differential diagnosis. And you have to really be not just curious and not just inquisitive. You have to be relentless in terms of finding an explanation for somebody's symptoms and somebody's presentation. Again, pulmonary hypertension is not something that people dabble in. It's not something that we see, you know, it's not something we see every day.
What is its relative rarity?
That's a good question. How much do we see it? I don't know.
I mean, for example, in my reporting, uh-huh. I've interviewed people, professional swimmers and basketball players who suddenly collapsed. And in further diagnosis, it turned out that they had PAH.
Right. So, yeah. So, again, you know, PAH is not something that's going to necessarily show up on routine mm-hmm. testing. Okay. So, a kid or a young adult, you know, goes to a doctor, you know, they do some basic testing. And unless you're looking for it, it's not necessarily going to make itself known. So kids may feel fatigue, they may feel shortness of breath, they may feel chest discomfort, they may have other signs and symptoms that indicate that something's not quite right. But, you know, unless it's something that really, really stands out as super prominent, it's often overlooked, or other reasons are found for these things, or excuses are found for these things. So the idea is that, you know, again, you really have to keep in mind, you know, that there are things out there that are not necessarily run of the mill. They're not. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, is there any role that gene therapy can play in potential therapies for either of these two diseases?
Don't know.
And the treatments that are out there for specifically for pulmonary hypertension right now, can you talk a bit about those therapies?
Sure. So, you know, again, you know, not that anybody wants pulmonary hypertension, okay? Certainly nobody does, but the treatments get better all the time. And the thing is that, you know, again, whereas several years ago there was almost nothing, right? Now there are medications that significantly lower, you know, pressures, that significantly improve heart function. And, you know, one of the things is that when it comes to any of these conditions related to the respiratory system, related to the cardiovascular system, things don't happen in a box, right? And what I mean by that is pulmonary hypertension, essentially we're talking about increased pressures in the pulmonary circulation, but the pulmonary circulation doesn't exist on its own. Pulmonary circulation goes back to the right side of the heart. So if you have a problem in the pulmonary circulation and it backs up, now we could have problems in the right side of the heart. If the right side of the heart, you know, starts to fail, we can then have problems in other areas of the body. We can have problems in the left side of the heart. So a huge, you know, a huge goal of any of these types of management programs is going to be to treat the initial underlying condition and also to prevent secondary complications from occurring. And the kind of earlier we can get on board with this, the earlier we can be aware of what we're dealing with and get people on optimal medical management from a pharmaceutical perspective, get them on optimal behavioral management, meaning things like cardiopulmonary rehab, good nutrition, managing stress and anxiety, prevention of infection, you know, trying to stave off exacerbations, you know, trying to keep people in remission, you know, indefinitely. All these things contribute not only to a longer life, but to a more valuable, more healthy, more, you know, greater quality of life across the board.
On that note, I think we've had a nice conversation. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.